On this episode, we discuss Grand Isle,
also known as Accents, the movie.
Everyone, and Merry Cagemas. Ho, 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 I'm Dan McCoy.
I'm Stuart Wellington.
I'm just regularly a Kalen. I'm not a ghost or a Santa or any of those things.
Okay.
Just a regular old guy.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like part of, I think at its heart, this show is an improv podcast, and Elliot just fucked it up.
I did not doubt Elliot, the reality that either of you guys were living in. No, I'm the character in the SNL sketch who's like, what? That's crazy.
Yeah.
Huh? Uh-huh. Why would you do that? You know, the character you don't need.
Like an audience. It's an audience surrogate. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Finally, there's a character in the sketch that's expressing what I want to know.
Uh-huh.
Wow. Elliot Kalin's dismissing the concept of the straight man outright.
Mm-hmm. No, Daniel. No. There's a difference between a straight man and
I
a character.
I think the straight man has had enough say in Hollywood, well, don't you think, Dan? Let's hear it for the boy. I think not.
What? a clapping hands emoji, clapping hands emoji. Great. Dan, I think the difference is the straight man in a sketch is usually the one who is annoyed by what's going on, whereas the straight man in a lot of the older SNL sketches, I don't know if they still do it. I haven't watched the show in a long time. Is there to kind of point out to the audience that there is a premise and to make sure the audience didn't miss what's going on.
I'll be honest. Sometimes I need the premise, the fact that there's a premise pointed out to me, because occasionally they'll put on a sketch where they appear to shift premises every few minutes that alarms me. Yeah.
Hey, if you can't deal with the new TikTokification of SNL, where it's just a new piece of content every couple of seconds, then I guess I'll leave it up to the young people like me and Stu.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yeah. I mean, I need all of my content to be immediately GIF-ified or JIF-ified. Which is it, Dan?
Well, GIF-ified is when it's animated, and JIF-ified is when it becomes peanut butter.
Delicious.
Well, as you no doubt.
But not allowed in schools anymore. Thanks, Obama.
No.
As you no doubt. Guest by now, this is a podcast about bad movies, not a bad movie. If it was about one bad movie, that would probably be the worst idea of all time, but instead it's about many bad movies. It's called The Flophouse.
Now, do you mean it would be the worst idea of all time, or it would be the podcast the worst idea of all time?
Okay. Well, who are a sponsor of the show, I guess.
check them out. They're funny, too. But the point is, check out Rising
Tide. Listen to this show. Don't stop listening to this and go to another podcast.
Stop listening. Nope. Rising Tide lifts all ships. Let's get the idea of podcasts out there into the meat space.
Take it. Yeah. Click it. Get on your desktop, drag the little icon to trash, and then hit delete Flophouse forever.
Anyway, the point is, this is a Flophouse.
It is. Well, it is. This is fair, dude.
Your Honor, I'll allow it. There's nothing untrue about that.
Wait a minute.
Is the judge a dog, too? This seems unfair.
So, improbably, not only is this...
Goes, Your Honor, certainly a dog can't practice law, and the judge goes, roof, because it's also a dog.
Oh, man.
Wait a minute. Why am I in dog court?
The Air Bud series where Air Bud is now a judge.
Yeah. It's when the Air Bud and the Lincoln lawyer crossed over. Now, the weird thing is he's Judge Dredd, but he's a dog. Now, here's my question. So William Wegman, he did those pictures where he dresses up his dogs in clothes. How come he never dressed them up in, like, costumes, like superhero costumes?
Off the rails.
Wouldn't you want to see, like, a big dog dressed up as, like, the Joker or something like that?
Yes, always. Mm. Yeah. What do you think Joker-fied that dog?
Probably that he was the Joker's dog.
Like, we live in a pack.
Yeah, anyway. Thank you.
Well done.
This is a podcast, improbably based on all that nonsense and foofaram. It's a reasonably successful one, and the premise is we watch a bad movie, and then we talk about it. And
Dan, tell us about Cagemas.
Cagemas is a special time of year where we honor St. Nicholas Cage, who is a great actor. Who's known for giving
on a hot streak right now, if you
ask
me.
Big performances.
Yeah.
But until, I mean, he seems to be coming out of it now. Maybe he's out of his financial difficulties. Until recently, he had not been making the best choices. I say this because I don't want to contribute to like this memification of Cage, where we're like, oh, what a crazy guy. Like, is he a bad actor? He's a great actor. I mean, Pig.
Big Rules.
You'll see,
long time listeners, don't listen to the Overkill song "Pig," which is a great song, but it's not related to the movie in any way. Long time listeners of this podcast will know our stance on Nicolas Cage is that he is a great actor who does not always know the best way to channel the amazing amounts of acting energy that he has. Much like Havoc, the X-Men character who must wear a special costume to contain the cosmic energies that he's always absorbing. Nicolas Cage is kind of like that with acting energy. And it's well known that
Elliot, when you fill out one of those based on your answers to these questions, which X-Men character are you? Because I usually get like Havoc.
Usually.
You do?
I filled out a lot of these because the first time I got Havoc, I'm like, oh, that sucks. He just explains his powers and then never uses them.
I mean, because he's so scared of him, and he's always living in his brother's shadow, too.
I know.
Well, I mean, to me, you know that I'm probably Nightcrawler or Beast. I gotta be blue and furry. That's me. That's the life of a Jewish person, blue and furry. Yeah. Anyway, so, the furry part. But Nicolas Cage, it's well known he had a lot of financial issues for a while. He didn't pay his taxes, so he kind of had to take whatever movie was thrown his way. And lately, he hasn't been doing as much of that, which is great. Or maybe it's just that people are learning how to use him again. Yeah. You know. After his earlier
not to do another runs. Tangent, but Dan, I think you and I should identify and celebrate Elliot's growth by saying that he needs to be blue and furry, and then he did not say dabu dee dabu dow.
I was waiting for it, did not happen, and Elliot, the intervention we staged obviously
paid off.
Took.
Yeah,
I remember very well. You each told me how I had hurt you by continuing to tell you that I'm blue, dabu-dee-dabu-dye, dabu-dee-dabu-dye.
And in the middle of it, Elliot went into the bathroom and started, we could clearly hear him sing that song.
Yeah, sadly to himself.
Yeah, but I'm trying to get better and better every day. It's a process. So Nicolas Cage, he's great, and we like to celebrate him at least twice a year. Mm-hmm. And so we watched a Nicolas Cage movie, right? But we had to dig back a couple years. There was a time when we had a bounty of Nicolas Cage needs to pay his bills movies, usually shot in Eastern Europe for very little money and released on VOD to dig through. But lately, like we were saying, he's been on an upswing. He had Pig and he had other things.
Color
probably.
Out of Space was good.
Mm-hmm.
Like Color Out of Space. Yeah.
He's going to play Dracula, right?
Mm-hmm.
That sounds great.
I mean, going back a little further, you got Mandy, you got Into the Spider-Verse, obviously.
Into the Spider-Verse.
Good stuff lately.
And we have Grand Isle. It's all great.
Yeah.
I don't know. So, Dan, what brought you to our movie this week, Grand Isle? Because you were like, we got to see this one, boys. Wow. And you had dollar signs in your eyes, and then your mouth hung open, and your tongue rolled up out, and you hit yourself in the head with a mallet, and then your tongue rolled back up again. Your eyes
and
turned
his
into
tongue
steam
was
whistles.
A giant dollar bill, but it was clearly a novelty dollar bill, so we could use it on camera.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It was like the money in The Wire, which always looks super fakey. Like they just photocopied a drawing of a dollar bill. But so, Dan, what was it about Grand Isle?
You know, so
other than the fact that everything about this movie screams thick gumbo of accents.
Listeners may know that that I'm the one of the three of us who, in his personal non-Flophouse life, still sort of maintains a dedication to trash in my movies. even though I am the oldest and theoretically have the least time to waste on this earth,
that's very true. And to put it into layman's terms that everyone will understand, if Dan was walking by the classic East Village clothing store Trash in Vaudeville, he'd say, I don't need vaudeville. Just give me trash.
No, you know, vaudeville's me, Elliot. I would want the vaudeville too.
Yeah, actually, Dan would like the vaudeville too. Actually, Dan's ideal vaudeville show would be like probably some comedy jugglers from the 30s pretending that there's a ghost in the room, and then just like an alien having sex with a woman and someone shooting the head off a monster. Like that'd be Dan's ideal vaudeville.
I find it very strange to think that there's anyone in the world who wouldn't be entertained by all of that. But anyway, the point is, I had read reviews of this a ways back when it came out, and I like a big slab of Southern fried ham in my movies. And also seeing that not only Nick Cage was in this, but also Kelsey Grammer felt like a good omen for our
with
podcast.
An accent.
yep.
Wait, are you saying the rumble from Money Plane is in this movie?
Yep.
And what's weird is, so Kelsey Grammer is slowly turning into the late Senator Fred Thompson, who was like an acting senator. And in this movie, there were times where I was like, how did they get Fred Thompson? He died years ago. Oh, wait, it's Kelsey Grammer. Hold on a second. Wait.
That's true.
And there's also, the other actors in the movie I wasn't super familiar with, but they also are very heavy Southern accented, like, too. And
yeah,
the writing of this movie, you literally have a woman in a bathtub saying to a man, why are you just standing there like a tree in the woods? And it's like, come on, it's a real, like, what would you call it? Tennessee Williams exploitation movie?
Yeah, it's Southern Gothic crossed with, you know, noir. Up until the end, which I'm sure we'll get to, where the movie flies straight off the rails into something I'm
like,
not quite sure I understand.
It's
into something
like,
really unpleasant.
It's kind of like the James Hurley bit from the end of the first, the second season of Twin Peaks mixed with People Under the Stairs.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought this movie, it really kept surprising me, not in a pleasant way.
You thought it was like, oh, you thought it was going to be a video game created by a son who wanted to reconnect with his father.
Yes.
Oh, that's what I wanted. In which his dad has sex with a bunch of people.
Yeah.
and jumps naked into the ocean scrotum first.
Yeah.
But we're talking, about the movie. What was it called?
Serenity. Not
Serenity.
Serenity?
Not the Firefly movie.
I wanted to call it Justice Fish, because there is a fish called Justice in it, right?
Mm-hmm. A Fish Called Justice, then that's a title.
Yeah, A Fish Called Justice is the sequel to A Fish Called Wanda, where they're all cops now.
Oh, wow, that's too bad. I don't think it's going to play well for test audiences.
And the judge is a dog. So this movie, it starts out seeming like it's going to be like a Southern crime noir thing. Then it's going to be like a sexual thriller. Then it turns into an action movie, kind of. And then by the end, it's a horror movie. But all through, it is such a – like, you could have taken this same script and shot it – and it released it – you shot it in the 70s and released it into, like, a grindhouse movie in theater in Times Square. And I don't think you would have – I mean, you changed the – not, I guess, topical references, because it takes place in 1988. But the whole time I was watching, I was like, oh, yeah, this is what it was like to watch, like – to unironically watch like a grindhouse movie in a movie theater where you feel gross the whole time.
Yeah.
Like there's sludge on you.
Well, also, I mean, this will make a little more sense once we've gotten into it, but as long as we're talking like meta things about the movie. I've seen this bit of trivia written up a couple places on the internet. I don't know whether it's true or not, but supposedly the screenplay was originally called Fancy Buddy and Mr. Walter. Fancy Buddy and Mr. Walter. Now,
shit.
I wonder. I mean, but I also saw a trivia that said Nicolas Cage ad-libbed all his lines, which I do not think
no,
is true. Because there's plot information. But there is one line, I'm going to highlight
there's
ahead
a few
of time.
That he probably did.
There's one line where he's so Nicolas Cage's character is talking to the hero, Buddy, and he says, so how long has it been since you've had your cock? Sucked. And it was like, what? And it's almost like Nicolas Cage in that moment cannot believe what he's saying, and the words jump out of him without him even realize.
It's
only while he's saying it that he's like, what am I saying? So that was a moment that's almost worth watching the movie.
Man.
Oh, it's awesome. Sir, this is a Wendy's.
Sir, I just wanted to know if you wanted a king size or queen size bed. This is the Marriott.
Okay, stick with me, guys. Elliot, you're suggesting that this could have been a grindhouse or like a late night Cinemax movie in the 90s, maybe. I'm going to cast that fucker right now. Walter is George Hamilton. Fancy is Shannon Tweed. Buddy is Billy Zane. Boom, scored that shit.
Yep,
scope.
You got it. Well, that's amazing. For a flawless victory that's on at 1:30 in the morning on Cinemax. But here's the problem. In the TV guide, it says nudity, which means a shot of someone's butt, not sexual situations, which means a lot of nudity.
Yeah.
So, Dan?
My one problem,
I'll go into what the movie's about, too.
Billy Zane seems too, like, both too smart for this part and too much like he would be the one embroiling you in a web of sexual desire.
It's funny how amazing casting can sometimes improve a movie.
Oh, okay.
Like I just did.
No, I do think that one of the major problems with this movie is our ostensible lead, is the charisma black hole of the film.
Well, when he has the amount of like sexual chemistry with Fancy as, say, like the chemistry between the entire cast of the movie Red Notice.
And I know you're confused. Fancy is not a golden retriever. Fancy is the name of the female lead in the movie.
Well, the name of the character.
Yes, no, the name of the character. It's Katie Strickland, who apparently was on a bunch of Private Practice. That seemed to be her largest credit. But no, I just think Fancy sounds like a show dog name to me. Or
and she's not the problem in this. I feel like the putty is the problem in this.
Yeah.
Well, and there's a number of problems with the movie. Let's go through it and we'll talk about it. Okay. So we start out. There's a creepy, well-dressed woman in a big house. That's Fancy. We'll find out later. She buys some Girl Scout cookies. She buys some Girl Scout cookies very creepily at her door. This does not play much into the rest of the movie, but I guess it just establishes that there's a creepy lady who...
foreshadowing.
It's foreshadowing, I guess, but we never see those cookies again. So it's not like these are Chekhov's Girl Scout cookies.
You're like, what's going on with those Thin Mints?
Yeah.
That's your go-to, or is it Samoa's?
I like a Samoa. I just thought that Thin Mint was like a more accessible comedy choice. I don't know.
That's fair. That's very fair. And do they still call them Samoas?
That's a good question.
Google it.
Okay, audience at home, Google it and write into us at do they still call it Samoas? care of the Flophouse, Dan's real address, Brooklyn, New York, United States of America.
I guess that is my real address.
Yeah.
So then it's nighttime. We see that it's 1988, and a thief is breaking into the house of Nicolas Cage.
How do we
Cage.
See that? Do we see it because they're watching a TV show that's only on in 1988?
Yeah, are they doing
it's just
Rubik's
the word,
Cube
the numbers, something? The numbers 1988 appear on screen. Okay. That's the extent of it. And later on, and I guess the TVs we see are all tube TVs.
Nobody answers his cell phone.
Nobody has a cell phone. Nobody Googles anything. Nobody has a digipad, you know?
By the way, I want to make it clear. I know that Rubik's Cube is an earlier 80s thing, but...
But they were still around.
It was like, you know, I feel like that's the lazy movies way of showing you that you're in the 80s.
Yeah. Nicolas Cage, who will later learn is Walter. So I forgot at a certain point this movie was set in the 80s, and he starts talking about being in Vietnam, and I was like, there's no way he's old enough to have been in Vietnam. Yeah. Oh, wait a second. This movie's set in the 80s. That night, a thief breaks into Walter's house. He gets up in his bathrobe and pajamas and takes a gun out.
He opens up his bedside drawer that has only like a few items of jewelry and a pistol.
And a loaded pistol. And he goes down and he tells the thief, you just broke into the wrong house. The thief, they start fighting. The thief escapes. But as he is about to jump over the fence and get away from the property, Nicolas Cage shoots him in the back from a distance. Thus, maybe killing him. We don't know.
And he does a little bit of banter, right? It's a little bit of like most dangerous game shit here, huh?
Yes. The implication seems to be later on seems to be that they like lured him in somehow, but we never see that. This thief, it's just a random thief. It's not James Caan from the movie Thief. You don't hear any music from Tangerine Dream. It's just a regular old thief in a very recognizable hoodie. Okay, cut to Buddy, our hero, played by Luke Benward, and you'll have to know, if you ever need to go north, just notice which star is pointing Benward, and that's the way that you want to go. So he's being interrogated by, that's right, Kelsey Grammer, who is just chomping off pieces of this Southern fried steak that he's got, like, and I mean that metaphorically, like there's a part where, there's this line where later on he's like, where do you think you are, New York, L.A.? This is Grand Isle.
What is a ute?
How many R's did he stuff into the word Grand Isle? And this thing, he's really doing it up. Kelsey Grammer, I assumed all of the scenes were shot in one location the same day, but he shows up at the end of the movie in a second location. So he might have been there for 2 days. And he's like, you've been arrested for murder. And I thought it took me so long to realize that Buddy was not supposed to be the thief from the first scene.
Yeah.
Like, it's not super clear. Because you've been arrested for murder. You got to tell me what happened, because right now you're going to the chair. Mm-hmm. And we have a flashback.
French fried potatoes.
it's a sling blade and so forth. buddy is he's trying to interest a guy who's just trying to sit at a lunch counter and investing in some kind of project. We never find out what it is. The guy at the counter has no lines, but Buddy follows him into the restaurant and keeps talking to him while he looks at the menu. Buddy says, "I'll talk to me about it later." Buddy then goes to see his wife and baby, who are in the restaurant already, sitting at a booth.
Convenient. So,
he just abandoned them. To
I gotta say, if you're gonna set up your day, you might as well stack it like that, you know.
Mm-hmm. It's like, well, I'm gonna meet this guy at his office, but at a certain point, he's gonna get fed up with me and escape to the local diner. You go to the diner, and I'll meet you there.
Uh-huh.
Their baby is sick, which is identified by it coughing sometimes, and they need money. Buddy refuses to let his wife work, and they haven't had sex in 6 months, which becomes a big plot point because. You know, she's still dealing with having had a baby. She seems to be dealing with some kind of postpartum depression, very common. Uh-huh. And there's a lot of tension between them because he has not gotten his beak wet in 6 months, you know.
Wow, so, sure. His beak.
Yeah. I assumed he was uncircumcised. And so it was more of a beak than a circumcised penis.
A beakman's world, if you would.
Exactly. Was that what beakman's world was about?
Yeah. Big surprise, right? Man.
Yeah, that's what Beekman Place in New York is named after, penises. So, Buddy, he gets hired to fix the fence at Nicolas Cage's house. And Nicolas Cage is just kind of chuckling, lighting a cigar. Nicolas Cage always has a cigar either in his mouth or about to go in his mouth in this movie.
Oh, boy, yeah.
And it's the fence that the thief broke, and Nicolas Cage, they banter over how Nicolas Cage is an ex-Marine and Buddy was in the Navy. And how much he's going to pay him for the fence if he can get it done today. And meanwhile, Nicolas Cage's wife, Fancy, whose real name is, what do you remember what her, it was like Francine something something, but they call her Fancy.
I missed that part. And I got to say, these two are totally giving off that, like, me and my wife saw you at the end of the bar and we're like your vibe energy, you know? Like, yeah. Nicolas Cage has his button down a little bit too far. And Fancy is very, very... I guess, explicit in her overtures.
Right. I mean, yeah, it's like they're constantly arguing with each other, Nicolas Cage's wife, but in that way that it feels like maybe it's part of their sex game.
Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf type. It's like, who's afraid of Virginia? Who's afraid of Virginia Woolf? Because it's the South, you know? Because it's Louisiana. who's afraid of Dr. John? That's the name of the...
A lot of Virginia Woolves out in that swamp.
well, we gotta see, what a dump. What movie is that from? I don't know. Anyway, so... His wife is singing and wearing lingerie because it's their anniversary, but he forgot. And she gets mad and slaps him. And he's like, "Don't make me mad." And she goes, "If you're a real man, you'd hurt me." And that kind of, she's like, "You don't have the balls." So it's one of those relationships where it's not healthy. It's not a healthy relationship.
Oh, okay,
I guess
cool.
Is what I'm saying. I guess a healthy marriage is not built on threats and challenges. You know, like, it is good for your spouse, your partner, to challenge you, to make you think new ways, to get you out of your comfort zone sometimes, but not to challenge you to hit them or
to
like
do a duel.
Show your real man.
That's why why I am still in love with my partner, the Dark Souls franchise.
You're saying it does challenge you in the right ways?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That was such a beautiful ceremony when you and Dark Souls got married. Yeah,
I know. And the dancing.
It had to be in Croatia, the only country where a video game and a person can get married. But, you know, but that's going to change with meta and everything. So,
and I don't need to tell you guys, but the wedding night was spectacular.
Wait, why don't you need to tell us?
I don't
Were
need
we there?
I don't need to tell you.
Yeah, because he was Twitch streaming the whole thing. Yeah.
Twitch streaming it. Speed running it.
I don't have to tell you because you watched my YouTube cut down of the night. But it was spectacular. So Buddy's fixing the fence. The wife is drinking. The TV news talks about how there's a missing teen, which we know is that thief. There's a big storm coming. And you can tell that she's got her eye on Buddy. She's got her mind set on him. And they have kind of kindergarten-level flirting and innuendo. It's like, like even a kid would be like, are you just talking about sex right now?
Well, I love how aggressive she is. And he's not even really playing it dumb or anything. He's just like, what? Okay. Sure, yeah. I mean, it's like not too far from the reoccurring Pete Davidson sketch on Saturday Night Live where he's just like a dumb guy who keeps getting flirted with.
Who just like agrees to everything.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a real opening couple minutes to a porn video energy between the two of them.
Yes.
You know, there's not so, it's like not sexual tension so much as it is like making an appointment for sex at some point later in the movie.
Yeah.
And Fancy even says at one point, I always loved the calm before the storm. And it's like, come on, come on, movie. He hits his finger with a hammer because he's distracted watching, because he hates to see her love leave, but he loves to watch her go.
He was watching her butt as she walks away, and he decides to take that moment to nail in the hammer. Like, you know, like, these are two things that can be done sequentially. You don't have to.
but he's got to get that fence done today if he's going to make that money. So he's got to multitask.
I got to save these 2 seconds and not look at my hand.
He's rising grind, baby.
Well, but it's also like he needs, like in the movies when they need to keep the caller on the line so they can trace where the call's coming from. He's like, still downloading this image into Spank Bank. Deposit not finished. Deposit not finished. Ow. Oh, I was so close. 99%. Anyway, she gives him a Band-Aid and she kisses his thumb. Nicolas Cage walks in and it's tense. And he and Fancy just keep trying to get a rise out of each other. This is going to happen the whole movie. Nicolas Cage, he's drinking. He starts shooting beer bottles off the fence with a sniper rifle off the roof right next to where Buddy is. And Buddy, understandably, gets mad. He should report it to OSHA. This is not a safe workplace if your boss is shooting beer bottles next to your head. You know, it reminds me of, Dan, were you there? Was this during your time at The Daily Show where there was a dartboard set up next to my head above my desk? Where was this before you joined?
I think by the time I got there, it was in that little alcove.
It was by the emergency exit, which was still not great.
That was constantly filled with chairs.
Yeah,
so such people, that the woman in charge of the space had to keep going back, being like, "You can't put these chairs here."
Yeah, this is a fire exit. Yeah, there's my then office partner Sam Means, who's a great television writer. He loves British pub culture, so he wanted to get a dartboard in our office, but I guess the only place to put it, because his framed pictures were on the other wall, was on the wall next to where my head is, and so I would have to work while the other writers would come in and throw darts at the board, and I'm being a nice guy, so I just gritted my teeth and white-knuckled it through my scripts while darts almost hit me in the head. And then when I moved to a different office and another writer took that room, she was like, this is not happening. And they moved the dartboard to the emergency exit area. But it's a little bit like that. It's not safe.
Also, Sam is such a sweet, gentle man that it's surprising to me to think about him like not realizing the danger he's putting you in.
I think he just didn't think about it. He was just so excited about setting up that dartboard and making it like a real, like the writer's offices in the movies and the TV shows.
Where
there's games and
where
stuff.
People are throwing pencils at the ceiling.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Oh, fun stuff like that. Yep. So the storm is arriving. Buddy's barely done any work fixing the fence, which is ridiculous. He's been working on it all day. And Nicolas Cage is like, I'm not going to pay you. I told you to finish it in one day. And Buddy wants to leave, but his truck won't start. Uh-oh. And we learn that we briefly haven't talked to Kelsey Grammer, but we learned that he was a thief as a teen. He robbed a store.
Kelsey Grammer was?
No, Buddy was. Kelsey Grammer's like, you must have killed those people. You got arrested for robbing a store once when you were a kid. It's like that seems like a big ramping up.
Yeah.
But Buddy goes back to the house. He says, Nicolas Cage, can I borrow your car? And Nicolas Cage goes, no. he says, so you leave your truck here and you get to take my Mustang? I don't think so. He says, get comfy. And Buddy calls his wife, who is justifiably annoyed that she's going to have to ride out a hurricane with a crying baby. Her husband is having a great time dealing with the violent sexual tension of this horrible couple.
Mm-hmm.
Guys, how would you apologize to your wife over the phone for the fact that you're not there with her during a hurricane because you're busy being in like a Z-grade erotic thriller?
I mean, I think at this point, I don't think he's done anything wrong. You know, he's just flirted a bunch, nailed shit poorly.
Oh, wow.
I would be like, honey, I'm sorry. I've been caught in a web of deceit and seduction. I don't know how to get out of it yet.
Yeah.
And like, I mean, granted, he knew when he put on that sleeveless shirt that he was going to be attracting some undue attention from this couple.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a difficult thing because obviously I understand, you know, not wanting to be alone with a sick baby in a hurricane, but but also he, you know, he, like, Nicolas Cage has set him up so to trap him here for a hurricane, and there's not, like, you know, he can't get to her safely. It's you know, it's one of those situations you enter into where, like, no one's totally right. You just gotta say you're sorry.
So yeah, Dan, you're like the buddy in this situation, right? I could see you as kind of that guy who, like, you're like a guy who's good with his hands, and you're just helping out, and then you get tricked or swindled into some kind of homoerotic. Well, maybe. I mean, there's
a little bit of that. I think.
Yeah. I see myself more as the sick baby.
Fair. I think, yeah, Stuart's the buddy. I'm probably, Kelsey Grammer? And I think and Dan's the
sick
baby. I got
to tell you,
okay?
And if I was in Buddy's position, I'd probably do the same dumb shit.
So Buddy joins them for dinner of meatloaf and fancy, not the singer, but eating the food. And it's not like Rocky Horror where the she tells the story about how she and Nicolas Cage met, she and Walter met, and she actually has the line, he was an alluring mix of strength, courage, and hope, which is like, don't read the stage directions. Come on, what are you doing? And they keep hinting at like a secret backstory that the movie never really quite digs out.
Yeah.
There's lots of tension, and Nicolas
Cage
accuses...
Save it for the sequel or the prequel.
Mm. Yeah. The prequel. Walter accuses Buddy of wanting to have sex with his wife, and she's being all sultry. And there's a moment here where That's where he says that amazing line where Nicolas Cage cannot even believe the words coming out of his mouth. he spits the words out as if he's like, I gotta get these out quick or my brain will stop me from saying them.
Or if he puts a big enough pause between cock and suck to feel like there won't
like
be
maybe
a correlation
it'll fly past
anymore.
The sensors. Yeah. Like, maybe it'll sound like two different thoughts, and the people at Standards and Practices won't stop me from saying it.
You're allowed one non-sexual cock in your movie, so.
And that's how they got that G rating. That's why this is on Disney Plus. So, and then he gets up from his chair so amazingly loudly. And I don't know if this struck you guys, but he gets up from his chair super fast, and the chair almost sounds like it's cracking to pieces under the force of him wanting to escape this scene so badly. Nicolas Cage passes out in front of the TV. Fancy briefly shows Buddy around the house. They see the basement door has multiple locks on it, and she teases him that there are very bad things down there. And then they go to her favorite room, which is full of weird little dolls.
And when I find a creepy Southern Gothic house that has a door to the basement with a shitload of locks, I'm like, okay, I'm going to have to go through all these fucking puzzles to find all this shit so I can open it. Then I'll have a fucking boss fight or something.
Yeah. Guys, I watched this movie, you know, I think we all often for the Flophouse end up watching these movies in segments, not like super frequently for me, but
every single time for me. Yeah. If it's not a live show, I watched it in segments.
This one, I watched the first half last night and the second half this morning, and I just now remembered the scene we're about to get to, and I'm so excited. Yeah.
I want you to talk about this. So on this one, she changes to a screen. She's talking about how hot it is because, of course, it's the South, and she's becoming the old lady who likes Tintin. So she says she's barren. She can't have children and starts telling him about her fantasy of having sex with a younger man. And she's sitting next to him, and she's like, anyway, then he would kiss my breasts. Should I keep going? And he's like, yeah, okay. And she's like, then he'd kiss my stomach, then down my leg. Should I keep going? He's like, okay. And she's like, what is she doing? She's like running at her hands on his leg or something like that. It all happens. It's happening at such a glacial pace. But I appreciate that she's asking his consent every step of the way.
It's great.
So if I recall correctly, then what happens next is that, like, you know, he gets spooked. He realizes maybe I shouldn't cheat on my wife. He like gets up. He trips onto the ground.
And he trips because all the blood that's normally in his head had rushed to his engorged boner.
Yeah.
So he got lightheaded immediately.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. His sense of balance was totally thrown off by how much harder his penis was than normal. Yeah.
So Nicolas Cage hears this, you know, this wakes him up downstairs. He very slowly walks upstairs.
Very slowly
ends up
the South, baby.
Like being behind the door. Meanwhile, like the, our hero, I guess we can call him, is on the ground, and Fancy puts her stiletto
gold stiletto heels,
her gold stiletto heel, on his crotch. And at first, I was like, "Is she going to do some like crushing action here? Is that his? Is that her kink? Like, is she going to stomp on those testes?" But no. What happens?
Dan, don't ever say that
again.
Making
wine. Yeah.
What happens is the stiletto tip. Like she puts it underneath his button on his pants. She flips her leg up with such force that the button flies off.
And now he's wearing denim jeans. She's able to pop the button
genuinely
off of
hot,
denim
guys.
Jeans.
Genuinely hot. That was amazing.
And like the button like flies so it's almost under the doorway so Nicolas Cage could see it. Mm-hmm. Nicolas Cage, who's like lingering outside the door but not opening the door ever.
No.
And she managed to open his fly with her stiletto heel.
Amazing.
It's a great scene. It should have won the Academy Award for scenes that year.
The Academy Award for most improbable sexiness. Where it's like, none of this makes any sense. Like how, just imagining the physics involved in the leverage she would need to tear the button off of a pair of jeans with the heel.
Yeah, I'm sure you guys were just
using
like
just her ankle. Just her ankle strength.
I was like watching this on the couch, and I had to take one of those couch cushions and put it over my crotch. And I made a point not to stand up too quickly, or else I would have fallen over.
Mm. Yeah. This was a moment. Yeah, this moment, it was like, it really felt, I mean, we've said this before for other movies where like an alien doesn't really know how humans do things, and they're like, what an alien is like, what is sexy? Well, I think this would do it,
yeah,
right?
Nailed
this
it.
Is
high heels
like,
are sexy,
like,
and
eye heels are sexy, and like buttons popping off of things. I guess crotches are sexy, and so what? If, just the idea that you would like unzip a pair of pants with the heel of a shoe is.
Love it.
Yeah. Anyway, they don't get caught. Nicolas Cage, like the mummy, just wanders through the hallways and lingers outside, and then walks away. Buddy's sleeping on the couch, all curled up like a little baby. The storm wakes him up. Uh-oh, Nicolas Cage is sitting there with a gun. He takes him to the attic. They talk about death and gratitude. Nicolas Cage talks about how when he was in Vietnam, he got injured in a friendly fire grenade accident, which meant he didn't get to go in country with his squad, and they were all wiped out. And ever since then, he's always regretted either not saving them or not dying with them. And Buddy talks about his experience as a sailor on the real ship, the USS Stark, which was attacked by an Iraqi fighter jet in 1987, and how his best friend was on the ship with him, and he tried to save him, and he couldn't, and he died. And that's when Nicolas Cage throws a bag with $20,000 in cash in on the floor and says, "Hey, Fancy has cancer. Can you kill her so she doesn't die slowly of cancer? Here's some cyanide. Just get her to drink it, I guess." And
he said, pour it on a rag and stuff it in her face.
Yeah, he does a great move that I actually missed, and Audrey like made me rewind to see, and I don't regret spending an extra minute in Grand Isle to see this, where she's like, "Put it on, huh? And he like does a little like
mime
of all three steps, but
And Buddy takes almost no time in being like, okay.
Yeah, this is a part of the movie where I'm like, all right, hold on, movie. I'll buy this popping off of the button with the high heels. But so this guy, Nicolas
Cage.
I'll
buy that Buddy's jeans are so worn in that button is barely attached. The thread is worn through. They can just pop that thing off with anyway.
Or that denim is stretched so tightly that just the slightest shift will cause it to pop.
Yeah, that's what's going on.
Yeah, because he's so aroused. Yeah.
No, but the idea that Nick Cage, who has been nothing but belligerent to this man, like just like awful to him the whole time, is going to try and convince him to kill his wife, like claiming that she's sick. And the guy is going to immediately be like, yeah, sure. Rather than being like, can I talk to her about whether she's sick? Or like, you also seem like an asshole. Like, what's going on here?
I mean, he saw those stacks, dude. He saw the 20 grand in the bag.
I mean, he needs that money. And also, at this point, he's probably just wants to get out of that house.
Yeah.
Well,
so it's
later
like,
on,
what
yeah,
do I need to say to get out of this house?
It is implied that he's mostly just like trying to play along with whatever happens because he's freaked out. But it is not particularly, like, I don't know. It
guys,
just seems like
the,
this guy drifts from whatever.
Think like, of the pants button he can buy with that 20 grand.
He's like, well, I do need some money to repair my pants, so thank you. Yeah, denim tailoring is harder to get around here. Yeah. This is when I think the movie officially shifts into what I would call lugubrious territory, where Fancy is just hanging out in a bath, drinking and listening to Strange Fruit, which is an interesting choice because it is it's a protest song about lynching. Like, it's not a sexy song.
It was a very upsetting choice, and also, like, she explains the history of it briefly, and then the movie continues, and it's like, what? Why did you think this was a point you needed to make a movie not about race relations in any way?
No, it definitely desexifies the moment quite a bit, which is maybe what they wanted. Maybe the movie was in danger of getting too sexy. They're like, we're in the red zone. We're in the red zone. Yeah. Let's remind everybody about America's violent history of racial injustice. Yeah. Okay, good.
You might have a blowout if you stay in the red zone too long.
we don't want the audience members' genitalia to just explode from the pent up passion that they're viewing.
All those buttons popping off.
They talk about their childhoods, and she talks about how sad she is, and then they start kissing. Back to the interrogation room. Kelsey Grammer's like, "You started. What were you thinking? Making love to this one man's wife, and he's right there." And he was like, "Look, I felt like I had to hit them against each other to survive." And I was like, "That's not, you would say pit them against each other, right? Like, not." Or he says hitting them against each other. Anyway, he says it. He means to say pitting, but he says it in a weird way.
But so, also, listening to that, I'm like, okay, Kelsey Grammer, what is making you mad in this scenario? Is it the murder? Is it the fact that you committed adultery? Or is it the fact that this guy committed adultery while Nicolas Cage was around? Because it seems like that's the part that, like, bothered him.
Why does it have to be one or the other? I think it's Kelsey Grammer's a church-going man, as he says. It could be any of those things.
That's true, yeah.
So you're doing adultery wrong.
You're stacking up them sins.
We trying to shoot the moon with commandments? So we realize that interrogation scene is just there so that they don't have to show the sex scene. We come back and they are lying on the ground in a post-coital embrace, Buddy and Fancy.
It's kind of weird because, like, I didn't get the vibe that this was the kind of situation that would necessitate a cuddle afterwards.
I mean, the fact
Buddy
is,
wasn't
there's
giving
so
me
little
big cuddler energy afterwards. You know?
And there's so little sexual chemistry between them that the fact that they're having sex at all feels so, like, pro forma for both of them.
Yes,
just feels like this is what we're supposed to do with this part of the movie, I guess. So yeah, the fact that they're, like, hugging when it gets back is surprising.
A lot, and he's not giving much.
Yeah,
that's true. Maybe he's just not that into her. You know?
Well,
Fancy,
I mean,
we can tell that Fancy is not great at picking guys, because look at who she ended up with, Walter. Mm-hmm. So maybe Fancy, although we'll later find out that Fancy is a monster. So maybe I shouldn't sympathize with her at this point. But, you know, maybe she just needs the right partner, or perhaps she just needs some time by herself to find out who she is.
Okay. Yeah.
Because if you don't love yourself, no one's going to love you for the right reasons either.
Yeah, if only she'd heard that before she started walking down this terrifying path.
Yeah, this lonely road, the only road that she's ever known.
Here she goes again on her own.
Yeah, so she finds the poison, the cyanide that Walter gave him, I guess just kind of rolled out while they were having sex.
He wasn't very careful with that cyanide, yeah.
And she's like, I don't have cancer. And he's like, oh, your husband said I should kill you. And
she seems kind of unfazed. She's just like, yeah, okay, I'll handle that.
And Nicolas Cage he's got full on crazy face at this point, but he's also hammering wood onto the windows on the inside for the storm. But he's like, maybe this is how you do it. Instead of hammering the boards on individually, he has big pre-made wooden board screens that he is holding up to the window and then hitting and then nailing in that way. Is that how you do it when there's a hurricane coming?
I think in places that deal with regular hurricanes.
Yeah. Okay. Because I wasn't sure if it was just a prop thing that we weren't supposed to see was one big piece, or if that's actually how you do it. If that's how you do it, then Walter, I apologize for doubting you. Anyway, she comes over and sweet talks him, which is just a preamble to stabbing him in the hand.
And it's great.
they get into a fight. He tries to force Buddy to poison her at gunpoint. Then he ends up fighting with Buddy. Buddy punches him a lot, really hard in the face. These are big, wet punches. Uh-huh. And the storm has gotten so bad now. Buddy ties up Nicolas Cage, and he's like, I want to leave. And Fancy's like, take me with you. I want to get out of here. And Nicolas Cage is like, she's got a secret. Yeah. Why don't you tell him your secret, Fancy? Well,
so, like, Nicolas Cage has been stabbed, beat up, and, like, tied to a banister. And then Fancy's all up on Buddy, and she's like, fuck me again. Make me come in front of him. And I'm like, lady, read the fucking room here.
I feel like at this point, this is the point in an improv scene where the game has been lost and no one's run across the stage to end the scene yet. So they're just kind of trying to figure out where to go with it next.
Yeah.
So Nicolas Cage is like, she's got a dark secret, and Fancy's like, let's do it right here. And Buddy's like, I just want to get paid for this fence. Like, none of them can agree on what the premise is.
I don't care about the secret. I just want
which, to be fair, if I was him, there's no reason why he should care about that secret. Just get out of there.
I don't know. And we all know Dan, being naturally curious by nature, would be very interesting.
I mean, I'm curious about the secret, but that's because I'm watching a movie where it's so clear that there's going to be a secret that's revealed at some point.
Yes.
So I want him to stay. But if Nicolas Cage wanted to, like, you know, yeah, trap him with the secret, he could have brought the secret up a little earlier in the situation.
Like, normally, if I ever need to trap Dan, I just put on a VHS copy of Secrets of the Masked Magician, and Dan can't stop watching.
I'm so drawn to Secrets.
Oh, Director Skinner, stop. The Magician's Guild is going to take you out.
So but now they're just trying things to keep him there for some reason. Because then Nicolas Cage is like, hey, if you should kill me now, or else I'll kill your whole family. I'll come for you. But you should first see what's in that basement. And Fancy's like, don't go into the basement. And if I was Buddy, just walk out of the house. Buddy, just leave. But instead, Buddy goes down the basement. And let me just tell you real quick that Fancy shoots at him. The power goes out because of the storm, and he runs, and she unties Nicolas Cage, and she's like laying it on a little thick with the secrets, and he's like, did you have to stab me so much? And yeah. It's like they at that point, the movie is not even pretending that this is not like some game they've set up.
Yes, you know? Except for none of that makes sense once everything's revealed.
Uh-huh. Like, that's true.
There's no like metagame that appears to have been playing in that way. Like, the only thing I can think of is, at that point, they have to work together because they'll be implicated together in what is eventually revealed.
I mean, it's really on Walter for giving Buddy the idea of going into
exactly,
the basement.
Like,
you know?
None of this part makes any sense.
Although, I guess he's hoping we'll get him into the basement, we'll trap him in there, just like we've trapped other people, spoiler alert, because Buddy finds the thief from the beginning of the movie. He's, like, got an IV in him that's, I guess, keeping him sedated. He's all weak. And the thief is like, there's more like me in here. There's some kind of kidnapping dungeon in the basement of the house. There's a lot of fighting and running around the house. Buddy goes up to the attic for some reason and fights Nicolas Cage there. Fancy knocks out Buddy. Buddy wakes up in his truck covered in blood, and the thief's body is there, and the police show up. They arrest him. He's being interrogated for the murder of the thief. And
we saw the beginning. Yeah.
Not James
Caan.
Yeah, we
saw the beginning. Not James Caan, not any other thieves from the many great thieves of movie making. It's not Bob LaFleur. Yeah, it's not Rififi, not Robin Hood. It's not Arsene Lupin or even Lupin the Third.
Oh, wow.
none of these characters. None of these famous thieves. It's not Raffles the gentleman thief. It's not Catwoman or any of the great supervillain thieves. You know,
Danny
Ocean.
None of these
great thieves. None of them. Yeah. It's not the guys from Going Out in Style. It's not the silent
thieves
partner
like
dressed
us.
As Santa Claus. It's not
thieves
like us. It's not They Live by Night. It's not any of those. Yeah, or They Drive by Night. I can't. Oh, no, They Drive by Night is about truckers. So it's not any of these thieves.
Drive by
Don't
truckers?
Think it's and it's not someone from Thebes. It's not Oedipus. It's not, you know, none of that stuff. So the police. Oh, and this is when Buddy is like, I want my phone call to my lawyer, and Kelsey Grammer is like, where do you think you are? You're on Grand House.
Well, and I want to object to this scene here too, because this is where Kelsey Grammer. Look, we all know that like they're like shitty cops everywhere, and particularly like. One is happy to believe, or not happy to believe, but will believe in some small backwater place. Like there's a guy who's going to railroad you for a crime that you didn't commit. Like, I'm not saying that that is that is any way unbelievable, but the way that Kelsey Grammer...
Dan, are you alienating our small but loyal fan base of small town corrupt detectives?
Yeah, I think.
I'm just saying that, like, the way that Kelsey...
They're a minority of listeners, but they're a very vocal minority. Those mm-hmm. corrupt small town detectives, yeah.
Yeah, I'm saying that, sure, it's believable that someone might get railroaded for a crime they didn't commit. The way that Kelsey Grammer is doing it, like, seems so half-assed for the amount that he seems to actually believe it himself, because he's like, I believe that what happened is you went out and you had sex with this man's wife, and then you, because you're a violent veteran, you found this unrelated man and you killed him, and I have no motive for this, and there's nothing linking you to the crime other than you woke up beaten next to the body, but there's no other physical evidence or a murder weapon or anything.
What gets me, Dan, is that he seems to believe the whole
story, but he's
telling. Yeah, it's like, yeah, it's like
when there's no evidence of that, there's only evidence of dead body and truck.
If Kelsey Grammer could say, this is all bullshit, there's no fancy.
I mean,
he wouldn't say
bullshit. He'd say like hog swallow or something.
Yeah, he'd be like, this is there's a lot of honey butter going on in this churn house. Like that's what he'd say, something like that. But he's like, okay, I buy your story until the part where you say you didn't kill this guy, but everything up till then, say, yes, that's God's honest truth.
Yeah,
I understand.
Not so fast. When do you get to the part where you implicate yourself in a murder?
Mr. Kaiser Soze, I believe everything you said, except for at the end, you are the killer.
Oh, man, you got
him. Well, you got me, but you got me wrong.
But the wrong way. I mean, I see your math, but it's the wrong math, but it brought you to the right answer somehow. Anyway, arrest him. On what charges? I'll tell you the story.
Oh, man. If only the test audiences had felt that way by Usual Suspects, and they had to just arrest him at the end. Like he gets into a car and there's somebody there slapping handcuffs on.
The driver, Pete Postlewaite, turns around and puts a gun in his face and goes, "You're under arrest. I was undercover all this time." There must be. I guarantee a studio executive at one point was like, "Why doesn't it end with him? Why don't you then show a scene of him getting stopped, getting on a plane or something?" And they throw him in jail. You know, mm-hmm. happy endings.
Grand Isle, though, to return to the movie that we're talking about. This,
you mean Grand Isle?
This, as soon as they leave...
You know, I was just an aisle, and then my kids have kids. Now my grand aisle.
As soon as they leave the flashback portion of the movie, which, by the way, Audrey pointed out that everything that we're seeing earlier in the movie is ostensibly this flashback, although there are plenty of scenes where Buddy was not in the room.
Yeah,
so
I don't know what he's telling
Kelsey Grammer at those times, but
he's got to juice up his story. Ryan issue. Yeah, that Buddy was, maybe Buddy's like, oh, in this part I was hiding in a closet, so I heard this part. Or there was a vent. I was in the bathroom, but I could hear through a vent when they were plotting against me, you know?
As soon as the flashback ends and we enter present day.
Act three, let's call it.
The movie, which, you know, has been shaky but enjoyable up until this point, really flies off the rails. So this is the part where...
I'll give it this. I did not like this movie, but I think it was the ever greater sense of grime and moral corruption of the universe that it was pouring onto me.
It's a heavy weight for you to carry, Elliot, but I'm glad you did it.
It is. But boy, I'm gonna carry that weight a long time. Mm-hmm. But at this point, it's been a pretty tight movie up till now. Minimal locations, minimal characters. Yeah, this is when the movie is like, we kind of don't know what happens next in this movie.
Yeah.
And it reminds me, there's the story that Matt Damon and Ben Affleck have told about how they wrote like 40 different endings for Good Will Hunting because they weren't quite sure what to do with it. And so they had an ending where Ben Affleck's character gets killed in a work accident. They had an ending where Robin Williams' character somehow becomes a construction foreman and becomes their boss. Like they really didn't know, according to them, what they were doing. And it feels like that's what happened with this movie where they were like, we have 10 different endings. Let's just pick one.
Yeah.
Because the movie, it kind of runs, it goes through the, it, runs in place for a while. They send Buddy's wife in for a scene that doesn't really mean anything other than she's mad at him. Mm-hmm. And Kelsey Grammer's partner sees something in an old missing persons case file that reminds her of something Buddy said. They go to Nicolas Cage's house, and Nicolas and Walter and Fancy just kind of stand around while the cops one by one go into the basement, I guess disappear for a moment.
Yeah.
And then
I got so mad too, because like the woman who makes the connection and like leaves one cop behind to watch them. And she says, you know, stay on them. And he just like keeps like ducking his head to like look at something in the hall, which like it's not even clear what it is. He has literally one job, which is to keep his eye on these people.
He's an easily distracted cop. They find a kidnapped woman in the basement, and there's something about they say something about how they wanted to expand their family. And Walter has an amazing getting away from a cop line. He goes, my cat's up a tree. Can you shoot him down? And he goes, what? He said, my cat's up a tree. Yeah. Shoot him down. And he punches him and runs away.
Quite reasonably, the police officer says, what?
But it's such a funny, and that I believe is, I mean, I would believe that as an ad-libbed Nicolas Cage line, that they were like, just say something to distract the cop. Okay, my cat's up a tree. Can you shoot him down? And Nicolas Cage escapes. Fancy is caught. Buddy is released, but his wife leaves him. Time passes, as represented by a radio news story. We have a scene where Buddy wakes up in the middle of the night because he thought he heard something. He walks around, and then he goes back to bed. The movie is like, if we keep making scenes, something will happen. Like, eventually something will happen. And it does, because Buddy is he's at the diner, and we hear on the radio that Walter is on the loose. Buddy, they found all these missing teens were found in the basement of this house.
Yep.
Buddy's at the diner, and Walter shows up shaved. Up to this point, he's had long hair and a long beard, shaved and in his Marines uniform.
Uh-huh, which I know from seeing Con Air that as soon as you see Nicolas Cage in a fucking uniform, shit's about to go down. You're like, Captain Corelli, watch out. That mandolin is sharp. It will cut you, sir.
Is that what happens? Does he get cut by a mandolin?
By his mandolin, yeah. I'm assuming. I haven't seen it, kinda, but I'm assuming it's about
like potatoes. Like, no.
Yeah,
no, it's,
you got to be fucking careful. Those things are so sharp.
Sure it's, I'm pretty sure it's a guitar mandolin. It's not the cooking implement mandolin that you use for making really thin things.
That doesn't make sense. I mean, like... I mean, it's a mandolin super useful to have in the kitchen. You just have to wear like a chainmail gauntlet to fucking use it, right?
Mandolin is also it's like a little guitar. I think that's what he has, but I've never seen the movie.
Can you cut potatoes on a little guitar?
I mean, if you smush them through the strings.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's like something that, like, I think in one of the Marx Brothers movies, they cut something by putting it through the strings of Harpo's harp. Like they could, it's like that, you know. That's how they invented the mandolin. So anyway. He has Buddy's wife at gunpoint, and he's like playing mind games with Buddy, and the whole part doesn't really make it. He's like, I thought I found a brother in arms, but you're really a coward. And Buddy admits that when his ship got attacked, he left his friend to die. He didn't really try to save him. He gets Buddy at gunpoint, and the cops show up, and Walter's like, release Fancy. And they're like, we can't. And Kelsey Grammer shows up, and I was like, oh, Kelsey Grammer went to a second location for this movie. Yeah. Like, maybe they put him up for a night in a hotel. Yeah. And he goes, she's in a lockdown mental institution. I can't release her. And Walter is like, the system was unfair to me and my Marines. We came back, and we got called names and spat on. And I'm like, movie, what movie did you turn into? This is not the movie you started as.
And Kelsey Grammer's like, hell, we could settle this over a beer. We could just talk over a beer. And I'm like, Kelsey Grammer, you have not met this character until this point in the movie.
I think he's low key trying to sell that fucking Yankee beer that Kelsey Grammer's been hawking in upstate New York lately.
I think he has
some like American
freedom
shit.
He's trying to de-escalate the situation, but also, it's never clear to me how well-known Walter and Fancy are in this town.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how big a town it is, whether everyone knows everybody or whether they are weirdos. Because the way he talks to him is as if he knows who he is already. And they have a huge house, and Fancy came from money, I think. But anyway, Walter, he draws his guns on the cops so that they'll kill him. Although he seems very surprised when he's dying. Like, he thought it would go a different way. I guess he thought he'd just keep killing until there was no one left on Earth and the dead would, the hell would be too full of the dead and they'd have to come back.
Kelsey Grammer's beer is called Faith American, by the way. Faith American.
And what is it? Is there a description of the flavor? What is it? Is it an IPA? Is it a lager? Is it a stout?
That's the brewing company. I think they do the Faith American Ale. I'm guessing it tastes probably super boring and not very interesting.
Yeah.
There is that commercial that was going around online recently where it's like 2 minutes long and it's scenes of Reagan and Bush and stuff, and like, and like, I'm the American military, and we're under attack, and that just ends, and it's an ad for a wine that just has a Republican elephant on the label of the bottle. And it was like, wow, this is a lot of buildup for just this wine that was called like Freedom Wine or something. But anyway,
is that Freedom Wine? Then turn it up, man.
Oh, what a lovable commercial! That was back when you could slap freedom in front of things, and it wasn't in any way political or polarization, because they're clearly like hippies.
Clearly hippies, yeah.
Well, I guess there was a time when freedom was about being like when you'd say,
freedom's,
hey,
just
freedom,
another
man.
Word for nothing left to lose.
Mm-hmm, yeah, man. You were a hippie rather than a fascist. But anyway, the scourge of Walter has ended. Buddy reunites with his family, and they say they'll take it one day at a time. And then there's this final coda, which is baffling, where the news is announcing leaves such a bad taste in anyone's
is
mouth.
Clarifying the twist of the movie that the movie was not like ineptly deployed earlier.
It's all the movie is like, oh wait, we forgot to explain what was going on in the movie. So the news, so intercut with shots of Fancy like locking doors and yelling or whatever. It says how Walter and Fancy were kidnapping teen girls, which we got, to expand their family and forcing them to have babies, which is for years, which is horrifying. Like, this is such a horrifying thing for them to suddenly throw into the last 30 seconds of the movie. Like, this is what it's like to see a Grindhouse movie. Because a Grindhouse movie would be like, hey, you know what? We don't care. We're just going to throw in the worst thing. Like, we're totally tasteless. Totally tasteless scenes.
The news anchor. Like, not, it's just like something you don't usually see in one of these things in a movie where, like, the news anchor clarifies. The news anchor's also, like, editorializing, too. Like, I guess it goes to show you never know who your neighbors are. And I'm like, movie, you're trying to add these couple of morals at the end about, like, not knowing your neighbors and also the way America treats its veterans. And neither of them seems to be of a piece with the rest of the film.
The ending of it feels like a contractual obligation for either Nicolas Cage or Kelsey Grammer that they had to have some point that they were making that's like their personal bugaboo, you know?
Yeah. Can you I just want to make sure everyone knows that kidnapping and forced pregnancy is super yucky.
And also we should take care of our veterans. Anyway, Grand Isle, everyone. Good night, folks. And it's like it's one of the few times I've seen a movie where I'm, at the end I'm like, wait, did they forget what movie they were making? And they started making another movie. Like,
is this like a very special episode of Grand Isle? What?
They picked up the last 20 pages of a different script, and they were like, just use that. Shove it in. Change the names of the characters. Because it's anyway, we'll go to final judgments. But this movie, suffice it to say, I did not walk out a fan.
So what do we do now on the podcast, Dan?
What we do now is we do final judgments. Whether this was a good, bad movie, a bad, bad movie, or a movie you kind of like, I'm going to say that this is like an interesting split, where I would say the first two-thirds of this movie is a movie I kind of like, where maybe it's not the most skillful example of this type of movie, but I have a real soft spot for like web of sexual intrigue, sweaty Southern Gothic thriller, film noir, like that gumbo, as you put it earlier.
I mean, it is very Serenity in a lot of ways. Yeah,
I find that stuff very enjoyable, even if it's not done at its highest level. And Nicolas Cage is having a lot of fun, and Katie Strickland's having a lot of fun too.
They're both like swinging for the fences.
Yeah, and then I would say
that, for sure, they are just hurling beignets and lobster and crocodile meat all over alligator meat all over the screen. Yeah, constantly.
And then the last third of the movie, I would say, for me, was a good, bad movie. There's a lot of distasteful stuff, as Elliot says. But if, you know, you're able to approach it as just some dumb movie, like, it becomes so silly at that point that, like, I still enjoyed it. But what do you guys have to say?
No, I mean, I think you're right on the money there, Dan. Like, it's that sort of thing where it's like, so over the top, the ending reveal twist is so over the top gross that it becomes funny because it's so like, it's so ridiculous and horrible and like, why did they do this? No, thank you.
Yeah, I wish I could like lose myself in it the way you guys have. It was a bad, bad movie for me because it was like, it was one of those things where like, and I'm I'll watch lots of unpleasant movies. I'm happy with a movie that delves into, you know, the horrible aspects of humanity, as long as it's not just kind of like drizzling it on, like with one of those sauce squirt things that they use in fancy restaurants, you know, where they're like, oh, we'll put like a swirl of this
raspberry reduction.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. You can't add forced impregnation as a raspberry reduction at the end. I felt like the whole movie I was like, ugh, this movie. And then at the end, it was like the movie was poking me in the eye. Like the movie was like, look at all this bad stuff, and then I'll poke you in the eye afterwards.
Hey,
so I'm going to say bad.
What was that? What was that movie that came out that had the blonde guy home aloning those kids who broke into his house?
Don't Breathe.
Yeah, don't watch that one either, Elliot. That's also got some forced pregnancy gross in it.
Well, yeah. if it's a good movie and the movie is going towards a like that kind of horror, then I could probably accept it. It's just like the fact that they just kind of threw it in. It's like there's a scene in the book of Blood Meridian where they go to this horrible place and it says like, oh yeah, and there's a 12-year-old girl chained to a fence post, chained to a stake like an animal. And I was like, I don't like that as just a detail you're going to throw in, like just to show me how super cool, extreme, badass this place is. I mean, he's not trying to show it as badass. He's trying to show it as a horrible place.
Yeah. But it was just Cormac McCarthy's sitting there with his sunglasses, staring at his fist in the rain, wearing a leather duster.
Cormac McCarthy and Garth Ennis are just hanging around talking about how they can make things real fucked up in their stories.
Yeah, we got a couple of Chris Gaines on our hands.
But just as the wit too, I feel like when something is when you're gonna put that much, when you're gonna put something that distasteful and real world horrifying in, it's just hard for me to accept it as like the sprinkling at the end. Like, did I forget to put some paprika on this? Oh yeah, and I'll put some forced impregnation also. But so I'll say, yeah, you know what? Great movie.
Just love the idea of Cormac McCarthy being like looking at his screen, like tapping his chin, being like, oh man, that's fucked up.
This will blow some minds. I wonder how the squares are going to handle this one.
Check out how fucked up this is.
The way I don't use that much punctuation, the squares are going to flip.
Cormac McCarthy, did it again, kid.
He sends the drink, bam, boom, pow. Comics aren't for kids anymore, thanks to Cormac McCarthy. Mature readers only. And he sends it to his publisher with a note that's like, dear editor, watch out. This one gets a little fucked up. Like, I was listening to a lot of Slipknot while I was writing this one.
Well, it seems like the only thing we can do is to thank our sponsors.
Now imagining Cormac McCarthy shopping at Hot Topic.
Okay. Mac is back, baby.
Cormac, more like Gormac. This is going to get bloody.
Let's take a moment and thank.
Now, what if instead of Mac tonight being a giant moon-headed guy, it was Cormac tonight, and it was Cormac McCarthy pitching McDonald's food for a more sophisticated adult audience?
Oh, yeah. But it's
all the pretty
it's
burgers.
It's more sophisticated, but a fucked up audience, right?
Hey, hope you can handle these burgers. Because they're kind of wicked.
Hey there, beautiful people. I'm Travelle Anderson.
And I'm Jared Hill. We are the hosts of Fanti, the show where we have complex and complicado conversations about the gray areas in our lives, the things that we really, really love sometimes, but also have some problematic feelings about.
Yes, we get into it all. You want to know our thoughts about Nicki Minaj and all her foolishness? We got you. You want to know our thoughts about gentrification and perhaps some positive aspects of gentrification? We get into that too. Every single Thursday, you can check us out at MaximumFun.org. Listen, you know you want it, honey, so come on and get it. Period.
Hi, my name is Graham Clark, and I'm one half of the podcast Stop Podcasting Yourself, a show that we've recorded for many, many years. And at the moment, instead of being in person, we're recording remotely, and you wouldn't even notice. You don't even notice the lag.
That's right, Graham. And the great thing about this... Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Okay,
go ahead.
And you can listen to us every week on MaximumFun.org.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
Your podcasts.
The Flophouse is sponsored in part by Squarespace. It's the service that helps you turn your cool idea into a new website, blog or publish content, sell products and services of all kinds, and much, much more. And they help you do this by giving you templates created by world-class designers, make it all look nice for you with everything optimized for mobile right out of the blocks. Right out of the blocks.
We're out of the blocks.
Yeah, box is like a block, I guess. Yeah,
they're both he's right.
Cubular. Totally cubular, dude.
Yeah, they're both totally cubular, Dan.
Everything optimized for mobile right out of the box. A new way to buy domains and choose from over 200 extensions, free and secure hosting, much more. Hey, go to squarespace.com/flop. For a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use the offer code FLOP, that's F-L-O-P, to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
Hey, Dan, I had an idea for a website. What? Anyway, it's called CormacDonalds.com, and it's a fest. And we've got our No Country for Old Meat. Yeah, we've got all sorts of stuff. Anyway.
Hey, you know those McNuggets characters that were singing and dancing and doing shit? Yeah. Now you're about to eat those guys. Isn't that fucked up?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, and they're all just like killing people and blowing stuff up.
I mean, those fry guys kind of look like the haircut that Anton Shakur
has. Yeah. The fry guys are just walking around with those cattle piston guns. And the Hamburglar, he stole from the wrong dudes, and now they're out to get him.
Yeah,
you know?
That makes sense.
And he's like, Grimace, you got to hide me. But Grimace's throat has already been cut. Oh, no, it's terrible.
Mm-hmm. This podcast.
I guess that bird. What's the bird's name? She's like the ultra assassin Birdie. That gets sent after him. Birdie.
The name is just Birdie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
This podcast is also sponsored in part by.
Now, Dan. Now, okay. I've got a different author McDonald's mashup. What if instead of Ronald McDonald, it was Roald McDonald, and it's Roald Dahl, but with the power of McDonald's. So what? The BFG is the Big Fries Giant. That kind of stuff.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Obviously, Willy Wonka would have a burger factory in this scenario. So, Dan, who's next on the sponsors?
The next sponsor is BetterHelp Online Therapy. We talk about BetterHelp a lot on the show, and this month we're discussing some of the stigmas around mental health. For example, some people think you should wait until things are unbearable to go to therapy, but that's not true. Therapy is a tool you can use before things get worse to sort of give you the coping mechanisms that will help you when things get bad, help you process and deal with your emotions in a healthy way so you can avoid the lowest lows. You're never going to be happy all the time, but what you can do is learn how to deal with and even appreciate your bad feelings, you know, understand how they're part of you. It's all stuff that therapy can help with. And BetterHelp is customized online therapy, offering video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist. So if you don't want to see people on camera, you don't have to. It can be even more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can be matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. Give it a try and see why over 2 million people have used BetterHelp Online Therapy. This podcast is sponsored by them, and the Flophouse listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/flop. That's BetterHelp.com/flop. I believe y'all have some Jumbotrons.
Jumbotrons. I'm going to go first.
Okay.
No, Elliot, you go first.
No, go first, Stu. Go for it.
Oh, really? For sure? Okay, I'm going to go.
Yeah.
This message is for the original Peaches. That's us. The message is from Perpetually Flopping in Portland. I became a new listener in 2021, and per Spotify's Wrapped, I've listened to 30,207 minutes of the Flophouse this year. Boys.
Wow.
That's 21 straight days of hearing your angelic spirits slowly dying over 14 years. For the amount of genuine joy you've brought me in a bad year, the least I could do was snag a Tron. To sincerely thank you, with all my heart.
Thank you.
So thank you, Perpetually Flopping in Portland. That's a lot of time.
I also like to celebrate with Tron.
Uh-huh. He does. He likes to celebrate with Tron.
I'm celibate because of Tron.
It happens. Sometimes lasers just shoot off your ding-dong.
and he does get stuck in an arcade game, and, you know.
It makes it hard, right?
Well, depending on if that's in your if that's what you're into, it certainly does. Anyway, our other Jumbotron is for Nick, and it's from Derek. Derek says to Nick, "Welcome to your 30s, kid. Hard to believe it's already been a decade since you were turning 20 and just starting to find your calling. A lot has changed in the world and our lives since then, but not the love and pride I have for you. I'm so proud of you, the things you've achieved, and the things you're going to achieve. Love you and see you soon." What a sweet, wonderful message.
That's adorable. That's great.
I love it when people have nice things to say to each other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. That's better than
that. Now what do we do on this podcast, Danny boy?
Let's move on to letters from listeners. You write them. We read them. That's the order of events. This one is from...
That's how it works.
Amanda, last name withheld. It's titled, "Help a Clueless Mom Learn About Comics!" 3 exclamation points. Hello. I'm looking to start...
Dan, give us each exclamation point individually, please.
Hello, exclamation point. I'm looking to start my 8-year-old son reading comics. He loves superheroes and drawing, and I think he'd really enjoy reading comics. I went online and wow, exclamation point. It's overwhelming, exclamation point. I never read comics as a kid and have no idea where to start, exclamation point. My question is, what comics would you recommend for an 8-year-old? Like, where do I start? Thanks for any recommendations, exclamation point. I love the podcast, exclamation point. You guys make me laugh every week, exclamation point. Well, I kind of found my way into comics through Donald Duck comics and Uncle Scrooge comics and old reprints of EC horror comics. And the only superhero comics I would read were the ones that my brothers. Yeah.
If Jack Davis heard you recommending EC horror comics to an 8-year-old, he would beat your ass.
but I figured you guys
Jack
would
Davis
have,
isn't here. Go for it, Dan.
Oh, wow.
I guess you guys would be better qualified to...
I mean, it's not a superhero comic, but I always recommend Bone is a great place to start reading comics.
That's a great one.
If
exactly
a kid doesn't like Bone,
I
don't know that kid.
Yeah, yeah. Some ones that are... So with superhero comics, it's a little hard. There are like younger reader versions of the different Marvel and DC heroes, but there's a certain level of violence in that I still don't love my kids... being involved with.
Although speaking of Bone, I mean, Jeff Smith also did that Shazam project that would be good for kids, maybe.
That one's all right for kids too. But I mean, but Bone is a magical series. Like that's a series that like is a the. But there's a series called Hilo by Judd Winnick that my kids really like a lot. That's a more superhero-y. My kids really like James Kachalka's kids comics. He has a character called the Glorkian Warrior, and that they like a lot, and those are more just silly, goofy than like adventure stories. But I would say you should ask your local librarian about things. There's also a series called Secret Coders, where there are kids who like use math and coding skills to have adventures in high school, but it's for younger kids. Or maybe they're middle school kids, but that's one that my older son likes a lot because my older son is about to turn 8. And he's a big comics reader right now. And a lot of it is him, give him one or two things to try or whatever your child's type of child is. Give them one or two things to try and see where they go from there. Like Zeta the Space Girl is a really good book that they might like. There's a book called Hereville, which is like a fantasy adventure starring an Orthodox Jewish character, but you don't have to be Jewish to read it. And that book is really good. Any of those I think are good starts, but Bone that's the one that like I was super excited to get my kids into, and it's just such a really great series, and it's one that they can read now and read again later when they're older. Who knows?
Yeah.
But
it's great.
Go to the graphic novel section of your library, and I bet they will have stuff for kids there, and the librarians may be able to help you because it is a growing sector of graphic novels is stuff for kids and kind of middle grade readers. And a lot of it's not superhero, which is great because the less you can limit what this medium can do in your kids' eyes, the more they'll have to enjoy when they get older. And the less they'll get stuck in the superhero dungeon that I live in.
Yeah. Mm. It's a great name for a comic book shop, though.
Superhero Dungeon. I mean, yeah. Android's Dungeon is the comic shop from The Simpsons, right?
Yeah.
Unless you have anything, Stuart.
No, I mean, I feel like it's kind of tough because a lot of the superhero comics I remember reading as a kid, I got exposed to when I was in like middle school. So that's a few years down the road. But I feel like maybe some of the like early Marvel stuff, but even then, like, having read some early Marvel stuff, I'm like, oh, some of these relationships are pretty booked up.
That's the thing. It's
not
like
in a cool Cormac McCarthy way either.
No, not in a like, hey, sorry, I freaked you out type of way. But you definitely have in the older, like, the older Spider-Man books, the original Spider-Man books are some of the best of those. But, yeah, a lot of the old superhero stuff there's a lot of gender assumptions, a lot of race assumptions. Even there's a lot of books I've been reading with my older son of old X-Men comics. And you're like, they're trying and getting it wrong in this one. But there's always a female character that kind of doesn't get to do anything and everyone has to protect all the time. And that's not great stuff. But, you know, let them introduce them to one or two things and then kind of let them loose to explore and find what they would like, you know, as long as they're not picking up Preacher or, you know, Faust or Veronica or something like that. Yeah, you know, yeah, they'll
Providence.
Be okay.
You know what? I remember, I know that you're a Marvel zombie, but I remember All-Star Superman being kind of a gentler.
I mean, that's a great book, but I wonder if I'd be curious how I haven't read it in years, so I don't know. But I'd be curious how it holds up for someone who is not. That book is so explicitly nostalgic for an earlier type of comics,
and I
wonder how that book works for someone who is not already steeped in where comics were at the time. But there
kinda,
are like
kind of dense too.
Yes, I think so, and it's got Frank Quitely art, which looks great, but is I think when I was a kid, I think I would have found Frank Quitely's characters to look kind of weird and lumpy.
that's what I like about it.
But I would say take a look at if you really want to show them superhero stuff, then take a look maybe at some of the all ages stuff put out by those publishers or something like Zeta is a not exactly superhero, but it's like a science fiction fantasy adventure, you know? So, maybe like that.
Let us move on to our second and final letter. It is from Michael, last name withheld.
Imperially.
I've listened to your entire back catalog, but this is the first time I've written.
Would you want to come on to my Sopranos podcast? Yeah, sure.
Despite the happiness you've brought to my life over the last decade, apparently nothing inspired me to get in touch with you and express my heartfelt gratitude until episode 357, Santa Claus the Movie.
What did I get wrong about Star Wars this time, guys?
For a few years now, this has been my fantasy that one day I would be famous enough or something to be invited as a guest of your show and choose for us to review this together, this thing which left an indelible scar on my teenage years. Let me describe the setting for you. It was the late 80s. An unusually big snowstorm had hit South Georgia. I stayed out in the snow too late at night, improperly dressed. What child in the Deep South knows how to dress for snowy weather anyway? And ended up with the flu. That year, Santa Claus the Movie was shown on television, and I watched it in a state of misery, unsure of how much of it was a fever dream. I distinctly remember the jarring anachronism of Cornelia and Joe being revealed to be in modern-day New York. Not only had Joe been portrayed as a Victorian street urchin, as you all noted, but Cornelia was being forced by her nanny to do Latin homework. And suddenly, McDonald's, Coca-Cola, and Joe calling Cornelia corny. Dudley Moyer's performance seemed insanely annoying, and when BZ was revealed to be Cornelia's step-uncle, he gave her an incomprehensibly sinister greeting, as if she, too, was finding out for the first time who he was. I do remember that he does a little whirl around in his chair, as if she's going to be surprised that, oh, it's John Lithgow. By the time the titular movie got to the drugged-up floating children, I felt sicker and more miserable than I could remember ever being. But for some reason, I watched it to the end. Now, it would be natural for you to suspect that I'm exaggerating about the effect, but all of it was true, and perhaps that traumatic incident had something to do with why I came to hate Christmas. Perhaps this is why in college I prefer decidedly non-jolly and gruesome stories about the Bishop of Myra, Nicholas, such as the one of him resurrecting three children who had been butchered and pickled in a barrel by an unscrupulous businessman who is planning to sell them as pork. Perhaps this is why I converted to Judaism and moved to Jerusalem, where I only occasionally see hints of a secular and thoroughly Russian Father Frost for those residents' New Year's Eve celebration. Alas, I will probably never be famous enough to be invited as a guest host on my beloved Flophouse, but this Hanukkah, you gave me a thoroughly unexpected gift of joy. Keep on flopping. Sincerely, Michael, last name withheld, Jerusalem, Israel.
I've always been confused by the idea of Santa Claus because it feels like you are doing, you're really making it harder for Christianity to get across to people.
Yeah.
When you say to kids, there's a guy, there's a magic guy with a beard, and he can see you and he knows when you're good or bad, and he's going to reward you if you're good and he won't reward you if you're bad. And then when they grow up, you're like, psych, that was fake. But anyway, the other guy with the beard who can see everything you're doing and he rewards you when you're good and he does not reward you when you're bad, that's real. Like, it feels like you are building in a disbelief in Jesus when you pregame it by creating this shock of knowing Santa Claus is not real.
See, this is good storytelling. This is like you create the red herring, the fake.
Yeah, Dan's got a point.
So you can spring the real twist on them later.
so the twist is that Santa's not real, but Jesus still is real.
Yeah.
I don't know. Anyway, speaking of Israel and Israel, welcome to Judaism, I guess. I don't know when you converted, but nice job.
Sure.
Now's another part of the show.
Uh-huh.
Let us talk about movies that we saw that we can recommend. The movie that I saw recently that I liked the most was Pig, which I saw
Pig
on the plane back from celebrating Elliot's birthday.
It fucking rules, right?
Yeah. And
it's a really good movie.
You know, I want to mention it again just because we spend so much time highlighting Nicolas Cage's lesser movies that I feel like I need to even the scales a little bit. But Stuart already recommended that one, so I'm going to go to Cop Shop, another movie I saw on a plane, back to Classic Dan here, as the world opens up.
we'll once again get more of Dan's Dan in the air, our special Dan's, segment, we're done.
Where his critical faculties are a little lower than normal.
Welcome to Mile High Viewing Club.
No, Cop Shop is a Joe Carnahan movie. He is a huge mixed bag as a writer-director, I think. But like he can do entertaining stripped-down thrillers. Carnahan?
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, what else did he do? He did The Gray. He did The A-Team.
Okay.
He did Smoke and Aces and Boss Level.
Oof,
not
okay.
as good, those ones, as the... But But this one was fun. And, you know, it's a redemption of sorts for another Flophouse favorite. Gerard Butler's in it.
Gremlin Battler.
He's good in it. Frank Grillo, who Stu...
Sure, Crossbones.
Yeah, Crossbones, yeah.
Toby Huss from Halt and Catch Fire.
Right, he's good.
Is in it. Alexis Lauder is the lead, and I was less...
I mean, Toby Huss is... I'm amazed that Halt and Catch Fire is your go-to for Toby Huss.
That's what interesting. Would it be?
What's yours?
Artie, the Strongest Man in the World from The Adventures of Pete and Pete.
Oh, he
Wait,
was?
Really?
And his many voices on King of the Hill. Yeah.
Oh, my God. Alexis Lauder is a bit of more of a newcomer for me, but she was terrific as the sort of the person who's revealed over the course of it to be kind of the lead of the movie. It's just a movie about this guy who's looking to not get killed, so he deliberately gets himself arrested, except for so does one of the people looking to kill him. And then there's
I thought you meant except for so does. That's the one thing he's looking to get. That's his one exception.
It turns into sort of an assault on Precinct 13 situation where he's inside this, you know, police station being held and people on the outside want to kill him. And I would say that, much like Grand Isle, the first couple acts are better than the last. It gets a little too crazy. Like, I like a movie of this type that's a little more stripped down and with a one foot in reality. And at the end, reality goes out the window. But if you like
Like in Takeshi Miike's Dead or Alive?
Yeah. If you like a, not quite that out the window, but if you like a good low-budget action thriller, you could do worse than Cop Shop. What? Rage, they're not all going to be like...
No, they're not all going to be fucking slam dunks.
About, you know.
No, I understand. I understand.
Yeah, man, I get it. It's cool. Yeah. I'm gonna jump in here and do a recommendation. I'm gonna recommend what? Another two movies? I'm gonna recommend two movies that popped up on Netflix. I'm gonna recommend The Fable and its sequel, The Fable, The Killer Who Doesn't Kill. They are Japanese action comedies. I believe they're based on a manga. The premise is fairly simple. You have the world's greatest hitman assassin, and he gets too much heat on him, so his boss makes him go undercover in Osaka, and he has to live a normal life without killing anybody. Of course, he runs into trouble, and he has to manage to maintain his vow of not killing anybody while also getting into all kinds of action shenanigans. It's super silly and funny, and the action sequences are fucking badass. They're great. I recommend them. The Fable and The Fable, Killer Who Doesn't Kill.
Speaking of super silly and just wacky, anyway, I wanted to recommend Malcolm X, directed by Spike Lee and starring Denzel Washington. I'm in the middle of this thing where every now and then I'm going back and watching movies that came out in the 90s where I was just a little too young to actually go see them. Mm. And so this is one that I was catching up on and I thought it was really great.
Yeah.
An example of – it's a long movie, but the movie kind of flies by, to be honest, and it feels like real – big budget, and I don't know how big the budget was, fairly big, I guess, like 80s, 90s historical movie making, and real epic scope. But what I liked about it was that the movie, among other, the fact that it looks great and it's really entertaining but also interesting, and Denzel Washington's amazing in it, everybody is, but that it's very much a biography of a person going through several changes emotionally and intellectually throughout it. And they really take his ideas seriously and the way they developed throughout his life seriously as like, we're not just telling the story of this person's life divorced of what was actually going on in their head that made them an important person. We're going to show you – and we're not going to show you like just one chunk of his life and make that representative of the entirety. They're showing how he changed throughout his whole life and how his thinking changed. And I thought that was really fascinating, that it was focused more on like his ideas and how he changed as a person in his cultural and social framework than just on like, and then this thing happened in his life and then this thing happened. Anyway, it was really great.
That's a really good point. I feel like it's so common with biographical movies of figures is to just focus, like assume they're this one person and then just present their life without anything.
Yeah.
Or there's the oftentimes better choice of like, here, let's just show a snippet, something like Selma, where they're like, this is just going to be a little bit. We're not trying to give you the entire picture of this figure.
Mm-hmm.
But Malcolm X kind of does that. It's great.
Yeah.
A lot of those movies, I think, give the impression that people are kind of stuck in one place and that they, or that they have a very easily defined arc where it's like, and this is where the story of their life ends, even if their life continues going. Like, this is their achievement. Whereas Malcolm X really gets across the idea of somebody who was changing throughout his whole life and was still changing when he was murdered. So I thought that's something that I haven't seen very much in movies. And obviously it's a different type of movie than like A Beautiful Mind, but it really made me irritated that A Beautiful Mind is like, this guy's a brilliant mathematician, but we don't need to get into his math at all. Like, we don't really need to, like, we don't, all we're interested in is the kind of like the details of his,
the easy, his struggle, like Oscar bait,
yes,
personal stuff.
Whereas this feels like a movie that really engages with why is this person an important person? Like, why, what is it that made him different or galvanizing for other people? Other than just, I feel like the easy way out is just to show someone giving speeches and have people go, yeah, yeah. And there's, this does more than that. So anyway, I was really glad that I watched it. And if the length of it puts you off at all, because it is like 3.5 hours long,
mm-hmm.
Like I said, it's a fast-moving 3.5 hours. Or you do it like I did and watch it in segments. Don't sit through it all the way through. And it's just amazing how – I feel like this was – all I knew about this movie when I was a kid was that it was like controversial. And the idea that like to make a big biopic of Malcolm X was like controversial. And it's one of those movies where watching it now, I'm like, I don't – like it's hard – I don't really see what's controversial about it. Like at least where America is now. It's like – I don't know. Just it was interesting to think about that when I was a kid, it was like this was a dangerous movie in a way, the way I remember hearing people talk about it. And watching it, I was like, oh no, this is a really good movie. This is not a movie that is going to that I feel like doesn't give you all sides of this person, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's Malcolm X. Go see it. It's on HBO Max, I guess. Or buy the DVD. I don't know. Or go to Spike Lee's house. I'm sure he's got a copy.
Or buy the VHS double set.
there was something about as a kid seeing any movie that was on two VHS tapes and being like, that's a movie.
Yeah, like I remember he used to be in two tapes, and I'm like, oh shit, like, this has got to be a movie.
When I was a teenager seeing Seven Samurai in the library as a two VHS movie and being like, this movie must be huge. There must be so much movie going on.
Each tape only has 3.5 samurai.
I want to see all seven. I got to watch both tapes. And then when the first DVDs came out and you had to flip them over to get to the other side, to get to the rest of the movie.
Uh-huh,
you don't remember that?
Those shitty cardboard like clamshell things. Man, those things were fucking trash.
And they
CD long boxes. Bring me back CD long boxes, baby.
No, it's such a waste of packaging.
you get that full bleed art, Ellie. It's amazing. It looks so great.
No, but what I liked about those crappy cardboard packaging was that, one, you didn't feel bad throwing it away because it looked like trash. You could just put them in a CD book.
What?
But also, they'd give you the titles for all the chapters right there on the package. When you open it up, you get all the titles for all the chapters in the movie, which was a job when I was younger I always wanted, was the person who named the chapters, because it seems totally unnecessary. It's not like the director and the screenwriter are sitting there being like, now as we make this movie, we got to name each of the chapters. We got to make it clear what's going on.
Our friend Bill Hickey always joked about how obvious it was in the scene in Roadhouse that scene would be titled Be Nice.
Well, that's another Cagemas for the books. Another year passed. I know it's been a rough one. I just want to say thank you to all
of you. Next year's going to be better, right?
Yeah, well, look,
it's going to be your year, man.
I want to thank all of you listeners for being here with us. I want to thank you, Elliot and Stuart, for being my friend. I know that it's hard to live in this world sometimes. I don't know why I feel the obligation at Cagemas to do a summing up, but like, just, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's the last episode of the year, I guess. But I mean, everything's
really
gonna be okay.
It's just not. There's more. I guess there's a mini afterwards. I'm just saying, like, don't let it get you down. The only thing you can.
I don't know why Grand Isle has brought out these emotions.
The only thing you can control is yourself. So don't. If you can, don't harden. Have empathy towards yourself. Have empathy towards others. We're glad to have you with us.
It's like Dalton always says, be nice.
Be nice until it's time to not be nice.
No, Dan, there's almost no times when you shouldn't be nice.
Yeah. Yeah, but Dalton says he'll tell you when the time comes. You'll know.
Okay, so wait till Dalton tells you, yeah.
When you get the
knowledge. Wait, so is that what B. Dalton Booksellers
Dalton.
Was? Was it Be Nice Dalton?
B period Nice Dalton. Thank you to Alex Smith, our editor. Thank you to Maximum Fun, our network. Go to MaximumFun.org for other great podcasts. But until next time, I've been Dan McCoy.
I'm Stuart Wellington.
I'm Ellie Kalin saying, Merry Cagemas, one and all.
Bye. Posting a TikTok of me fucking with Dan.
Whoa! Stuart, you really live more online than in meat space now.
The only meat space I'm thinking about is the one between Nicolas Cage's legs. That's my first try. I'm workshopping.
First try at what? I'm not sure what you're trying at.
Make like a horny Nicolas Cage joke.
Oh, I see. Okay.
All right.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.